We're going to reconvene now.
Senate
Interim Committee. Do I need to gavel louder? We're reconvening the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. Thank you for your patience. We have two more panels. First, we're going to hear from the Oregon State Bar Association. We just heard from the housing counselors about what they're doing to help homeowners out there. And a couple people have mentioned to me that bar associations are doing a lot to help fill the need for assistance. And so when I spoke with the Oregon State Bar, they were telling me about some of the things that they're doing. And I said, will you please come and explain that to the committee? So we have Steve Pucci here to tell us what the Oregon State Bar is doing in this regard. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Steve Pucci. I am a civil litigator from Portland in my third year on the Bar's Board of Governors. I'm the chair of the Public Affairs Committee and the president-elect of the Bar for next year's presidency. So I'd like to just briefly talk to you about what the Bar is doing in these times with regard to the foreclosure crisis. It's kind of a two-pronged approach. One of them, of course, is to do everything we can to support legal services funding, and that takes place both here in the state and on a national level. We have consistently been advocating for congressional support of legal services and to withdraw the restrictions that have been difficult for causing the legal services offices to not be able to provide their own funding. And fortunately, in the last year, Congress has passed, did away with one restriction that would allow them to actually recover attorney's fees in certain kinds of cases in foreclosure actions, as well as others. So we on the national level work with Congress and hope to continue to do that in terms of lifting the other restrictions that would help out legal services corporations. On a statewide level, we're of course down here and doing what we can to assist with legal services funding, and we certainly commend the legislature for the high level of funding it we appropriated in our last session. Now, in terms of what the Bar specifically is doing, we have about a multi-level approach to that, but of course we have our low-income legal services programs that we support, and we have pro bono programs that that create panels of lawyers who, and recently, who have been trained to handle foreclosure cases if certain lawyers are interested and we're not up to speed on that. So we have that. It has happened. It's ongoing. And those pro bono panels are free lawyers for certain kinds of foreclosure clients without a fee. We also have the longstanding lawyer referral service, which has continued to grow, especially in response to the economic downturn. Last year, our numbers were up significantly. I don't have the percentage, but we took over 100,000 calls from different Oregonians, and we referred over 50,000, I think it was 52,000, to attorneys. And it looks like also with our Modest Means program, which is those who can't afford but cannot afford to pay full legal rates, we have a three-tiered rate program. I think it starts at $60 per hour and goes up to $100. But between the lawyer referrals that we're sending out to lawyers who charge $35 an hour for the initial consultation, I mean, not per hour, but for one consultation, our Modest Means lawyers charge very minimal rates to those who might have some money, but not enough. Additionally, our Modest Means program has expanded to include foreclosure, certain kind of foreclosure clients, whereas it did not do so as much before. So we're working on that. In that regard, we've added staff with legal services or with lawyer referral services, and we've added a staff person in the Modest Means program. And we may need to add more as the calls keep coming in. Then across the board, we have different sections that do different things for people who are economically stressed, but our consumer law session has been putting on training for lawyers. That is the one that I spoke of with regard to foreclosure training. They've also put on some mortgage training for lawyers sessions as well. So those are the basic things that we're doing currently. We also have been developing a legal links program through a cable, I think it's in Tigard, the cable station in Tigard. Two of the legal links programs are specifically about people's rights and duties with respect to foreclosures. We're proud of that program, and it's actually growing, and we'll probably get back to all sorts of economic issues in the next year as we move on with that. And then we've revamped our website so that it's easier for consumers and citizens to find out information and get to these various services that we provide. That is basically the lay of the land as far as what the bar is doing. Currently, we're always looking to do more, and I would take any questions from our panel.
Thank you. I noticed that you say that when someone calls the lawyer referral service with a foreclosure problem, you first refer the client to housing counselors.
That is true.
You probably heard them talking this about how much work.
This lady here probably doesn't appreciate it so much, but that's why we're trying to train our lawyers to do those things as well.
Thank you. Questions?
Sure, Madam Chair. So is there any use, do you know, of like supervised legal students, law students, to do this kind of work?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosenbaum, I am unaware that we have any law school trainees in the foreclosure realm at the moment, but that is a potential. I can look into that and get back to you. We do have a lot of law students working as lawyers. As you know, in the third year, they get a limited license to do certain kinds of things, and very well may be that we do. I just am not sure about that.
That's a good question, and that's something that came up in discussions during one of the prior versions of Senate Bill 628 that required mediation. We had a discussion about the possibility of training law students. So it would, if you find out about any of the law schools that have, like for example, University of Oregon, at least when I was there, had a civil practice clinic, and I probably still does. So if they're working on foreclosure issues, it would be helpful to know that as well, so we can help refer people to get help.
We will get back to you on that. I do know, Chair Bonamici, that the Lewis and Clark Law School has a clinic there that's involved in many such matters, not specifically foreclosures, but lots of family issues have, of course, ramped up. The numbers are startling, and so I'm aware that they're on that, but we'll get back to you on the foreclosure and the training of law students.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak before you today.
Appreciate it. Thank you. And our next panel, we have Linda Navarro with the Oregon Bankers Association, Chris Ambrose with the Oregon Mortgage Lending Association, and David Fennell with the United Trustees Association. Thank you so much. Is David here? Yeah. Thank you so much. You had to sit through the whole hearing, but you do get the last word, so it's just a trade-off. Thank you for being here. And have you decided who's going to go first?
Mr. Fennell will be going first.
Oh, I want.
Sounds like it's news to Mr. Fennell.
I thought I'd graciously declined, but I was outvoted.
Do you mind?
Democracy prevails.
My name is David Fennell. I'm here representing the United Trustees Association. Our group is composed of quite a few foreclosure service providers throughout the western part of the country. My firm, Routh Crabtree Olson Northwest Trustee Services, handles foreclosures in approximately 8 western states, including Oregon. I've been doing foreclosures in Oregon, practicing law in Oregon, since 1985. 84. Actually, it was 85 because it's hard now. My bar number is 84, but I seem to recall not having my first job till I was 85. Nevertheless, I was asked to testify today or just talk today about the effects or the perceived and observed effects of Senate Bill 628. I guess what I'd like to tell you is that there hasn't been enough time to know what those effects are. I think the bill was effective at the end of September. Because our loan servicing clients, most of the majors out there who work in 50 states, faced about 20 to 30 states' new laws and trying to comply with those new laws, they were very slow to sort of get their systems up to speed and up to date in order to issue new foreclosure referrals to be, you know, basically so they were comfortable with being in compliance with the new law. As a result, the foreclosures or the mortgage servicers have been really slow in referring new foreclosures. We're probably about half the volumes that we had last summer, just because our clients are still ramping up to try to be, you know, fully compliant with the law. I guess the other thing that should be noted, I heard earlier some discussion about the affidavit that gets recorded at the end of the foreclosure. The Oregon foreclosure process is minimally a 120-day process. If you do the math from October 1 or so to now, we're not even at 120 days yet. And so there haven't really been many affidavits of compliance recorded at this point. So I guess I'm really here to tell you we don't know yet. To the extent that we've seen requests for loan modification consideration come in, those go immediately to the servicer. And in every instance that I'm aware of so far, that servicer has gotten back to the borrower with one of three responses that are required by the statute, either accept or deny or ask for more information. And really, beyond that, I really can't comment. I'm more than happy to take questions.
Thank you. In your written testimony, you say that in cases where the borrower has returned the request for modification consideration form, loan servicers have been conscientious and timely responding. So how many are we talking about? 10? Are we talking about 100? Is it one or two? How many have you seen where the borrowers actually sent in that I'd like to be considered for modification?
I would say it's less than 50 at this point. Now, you need a point of reference. How many?
I'm not asking for exactly, but yeah, approximately.
Yeah, it's. I asked our foreclosure manager that question the other day, and he said just a handful, and I didn't ask him to go beyond that. But my sense is it's less than 50 at this point. 50 out of possibly, 1,000. You know, and quite a lot of them have been coming in the last month or so, and they still have 30 days. The borrower does to submit the request.
And is that just on behalf of your particular company, or did you sort of survey other trustees around the state?
I did some informal canvassing, and they all tell me that it's just so new that they've just gotten very little response yet back.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Questions for Mr.
Fennell? I actually did have a question about the you're the ones that fill out these affidavits, is that correct?
No, we sort of worked with some of the servicers to come up with a form of affidavit that they could feel comfortable, checking appropriate boxes, but we don't fill them out. We don't. They're the ones who have to. They're the ones who have to select the boxes. They're the ones who have to sign.
So, just a couple of questions about that, though. I mean, when you look at these boxes, mm-hmm. I'm not articulating this well. So, is somebody actually tracking that someone requested a meeting and then was unavailable to meet? Because that's one of the boxes. I mean, when you hear the stories like the ones you've heard today, you know, about all the various things that happen, you know, if I were doing this job, I guess I would look for a box that most closely corresponded to something that I could document.
Well, I can't, sorry.
But so how are people instructed to really be able to verify the truth of what they're checking here?
Well, as the point person with most of the servicers on new legislation, I can tell you they take compliance very seriously. They assemble groups internally, and I'm talking about the major servicers, and even some of the mid-level servicers. They have formed committees. They have to get their tech people together. They're reshaping within how they have to comply to the letter of the new law. And as I said before, some of them aren't able to do it before the effective date of the statute, and so it slops over afterwards, and it prevents them really from referring out new foreclosures, or really slows down that process until they are fully compliant. How they actually do it themselves individually within each shop, I have no idea, because I'm not privy to that. But they have people assigned in at least one or two cases. I know of managers assigned just to make sure that, let's say, the Oregon law is complied with.
Maybe Linda will be able to enlighten us.
Oh, and by the way, if you don't mind, I'm sorry. The affidavit itself was created in major part to track what we could discern are the essential requirements of the statute. There wasn't statutes aren't drafted to make lawyers or give lawyers an easy time to come up with a point by point affidavit. But we had to sort of pick what the mandatory parts of that statute were and put them into an affidavit form. They don't all have to be true, just the ones that are checked, and some are going to be mutually exclusive. And so you can't obviously check everything. But and I too question, to be honest with you, how somebody at the servicer level is going to be able to discern between meeting requested or no meeting requested and everything in between.
Right, because people are signing these forms under penalty of perjury.
Correct.
That everything that they have checked there is true. So I guess that means that they could be brought into court for perjury if they sign a form and it's not accurate.
You bet.
Okay.
All right. Any questions, Senator Gerard?
No.
Oh. Who's next?
Okay. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Linda Navarro. I'm President and CEO of the Oregon Bankers Association and the Independent Community Banks of Oregon. We represent the banks that do business in Oregon, and when I refer to banks, I'm talking about traditional banks that have a depository presence. They take deposits in the state, they have branches in the state, they employ people in the state, and they're highly regulated as commercial and savings banks. So we do not represent all kinds of financial institutions that have been involved in either originating, funding, or even servicing mortgage loans. So I'll do my best to speak to the members that we represent on the issues that are before us today. There has been a number of topics brought up to date, kind of all over the map, really, from the secondary market to financial education to subprime versus predatory lending, and I would love to speak to all those issues. But what I'll do is stick to the questions that were posed to us in advance, posed to me in advance of this hearing, and then I would be happy to answer questions on other matters that are of interest to you. So, first of all, I'd like to acknowledge that there is no doubt, I think, in anyone's mind that there was a number of bad loans made. There were predatory loans made. It can be argued how those were made, who made them, and whether they were regulated properly. But what we're facing today, many of our banks actually have purchased companies and inherited, if you will, through that process, some of these loans that they in themselves didn't originate. Some were made by banks, and even beyond that, many of the cases that involve borrowers struggling with payment don't have to do with the kind of loan they received at all. As we've heard today, it's often factors such as reduced income, job loss. So I think we all agree that the goal here is to try to keep as many people as possible in their home. And what I'll focus on is Senate Bill 628 and how we believe that that's helped in the process to date, and then I'll talk a little bit about loan modifications. With regard to Senate Bill 628, again, we believe as well that it's very early. As for affidavits, I did not provide you any examples, and I haven't seen the example you have. It's up to each institution to determine what their affidavit would look like, so I can't say how they would necessarily comply with a particular form that you have in front of you. But at this point, Senate Bill 628 has proved to be on the continuum of communication that a servicer must engage in with their customers. One tool in the process. It comes at a certain time in the process to provide clarity to borrowers who may not otherwise understand that they are entitled to a discussion about loan modification. But typically, and not readily spoken of, is most lending institutions and servicers have made contact or attempted to make contact numerous times with borrowers before it gets to the point of issuing this form. So again, we believe it is a tool in the continuum of communication that must exist if there's going to be effective movement toward modification when it makes sense. I was asked to provide you with some example forms, so you do have a packet in front of you, and we included five different forms. They're kind of all over the map because statute did not specifically spell out a particular form, so it was incumbent upon each company to define its own form. I actually asked several of our member banks for forms, and I received probably a dozen different forms, so I just provided you with a sample of five different forms that are being used. Again, it's very new, and it might be possible for us, it's certainly possible for banks to modify those forms and make them more user-friendly, just as we embraced the idea of the plain language notice form when we were involved with the Mortgage Lending Task Force and the legislation that resulted in 2008. So there may be some improvements that can be made to those forms, but that's an example of what the banks put together with the limited guidance that was provided in the new statutes. I was also asked to provide, if possible, some data about the use of that form and the response of consumers to that form. And again, as you've heard, it's very early in the process, and there hasn't been a lot of time for these forms to be issued. But what I've found out is a series of, you know, examples. We're not a repository for data for our banks, so I don't have any aggregate numbers or percentages to give you. But I can tell you, for example, with regard to the local banks, up to and including Umpqua Bank, which is the largest bank headquartered in the state, they're using the form. They're not getting a lot of response when they are. It's not usually requesting an in-person meeting, but in almost every case, they've had multiple contacts with those borrowers before that form was sent out, and they're working on modifications. But many, many small banks have no foreclosures going on right now, even if they have retained servicing on mortgage loans that they've originated. So I know most of the concern is where the volume is, and that's with the larger financial institutions. And so, for example, if you look at Wells Fargo as an example of a larger institution, and their name was brought up today, they've actually reported to me that they receive an average of 20 replies per month using this form. Now, I don't know out of how many. That's data I would have to clarify. But they haven't had requests for in-person meetings to date using that form. However, again, there's a lot of follow-up that's involved once that form's received. And in fact, every bank reported to me to the question of whether follow-up was required. Yes, it has been required in almost every single case. There's a lot of data, information about income, and other factors that needs to be collected. And so that specific question of whether follow-up's required, I was told, yes, it is. Another question that was posed to me in advance was whether staffing levels have been increased at banks and at servicing companies, and I think you heard some examples of this today, but certainly the answer is yes. Again, sticking with the largest institutions that also do business in Oregon that are members of the OBA, I can tell you, Bank of America, which is the largest servicer in the United States, they've staffed up to 13,000 people working in default management right now. They've also employed something that I think is unique, mobile notaries, which are able to go around and allow a borrower to sign their documents where and when it's convenient for the borrower. Another example, Wells Fargo has increased its home retention staff by more than 7,600 people in 2009 alone, which increases their total U.S.-based staff to 15,000. So a couple of examples, again, of the resources that banks are certainly putting into their servicing to try to deal with the onslaught of volume that that they've faced in 08 and 09. I'll just make a few brief comments about modifications since that was raised today. And then, of course, I'd be happy to answer questions. There were some statistics cited today, and frankly, I'm not sure where those statistics came from. I have statistics that have been reported and recorded with the government offices and in press releases that I'd be happy to share, but there are modifications taking place. Is the pace quick enough for everyone? I'm sure it's not. Is everyone able to obtain a mortgage modification? No. But banks have been ramping up, servicers have been ramping up their resources and doing their best to work through a very complex set of circumstances. You heard some of that in terms of the differing interests, the investors, but there's also a pretty complex requirements set forth by the federal government for how you comply with a HAMP loan or a HARP loan, which are two terms you heard of. I would like to cite a couple of examples that I think might be useful to you to compare against the other statistics that you've been hearing today. J.P. Morgan Chase is a recent entry, new member to the OBA because they are a commercial bank that came to Oregon in their purchase of Washington Mutual. So J.P. Morgan Chase has a number of loans that Oregonians hold that they service. And I don't have Oregon data, but I can tell you J.P. Morgan Chase has offered 568,000 modifications in 2009. You heard the problem with modifications being made permanent rather than just temporary. 83,000 were made permanent in 2009. Now, that's not enough. There's more that qualify to be permanent if all factors were met. But they've also reported very specifically, and I have a press release that is not in your handout, but I'd be happy to share it with you because it does break down some of the reasons why the modifications haven't been made permanent that have been potentially eligible. Under the HAMP program, in order for a loan to be made permanent, the borrower has to meet the payment for a period of time. I think it's 3 months. 29% did not pay as agreed, so that disqualifies them from permanent modification. 20% paid as agreed and are able to be underwritten. And those are the ones that are quickly moving through the process toward permanent modification. 20% paid as agreed but have not yet provided the required documentation. And 31% have paid as agreed and have provided some documentation, but additional documentation is needed. That's what one bank's reported. I have many other examples of the volume of modifications that have been made. Let me just grab one more for you. I thought I would share with you that Bank of America was recently invited to testify. As you can imagine, this subject is a topic of regular discussion in Congress and in Washington, which does have authority and legislation and regulation that governs these institutions. They've reported in their testimony just recently that, and I think this is interesting because they've made 615,000 modifications under HAMP, HARP, and also under the bank's own programs. And I think what's interesting is 450,000 loan modifications by Bank of America were not made under the HARP program. So I think there may be some misperception that a bank is only willing to modify a loan if it qualifies under the federal program. They're, in fact, making two-thirds of their modifications without use of the HARP program. And I think that's important because what it boils down to is that in many, many cases, it is in the interest of the bank to modify the loan. It's in the interest of the servicer to modify the loan, because if you just want to talk dollars and cents, it's very expensive to go through the foreclosure process, particularly if you end up with bank-owned real estate that you have to sell, which never sells on the market, as well as private real estate, and not to mention that it can affect the value of other properties that bank or investor owns in that area. So there is financial incentive. There's also in the HARP program financial incentive built in for servicers to modify the loans. So I would just close with those points and tell you that, again, our goal ultimately, well, first of all, I'll say with regard to 628, we do, again, think it's quite early to draw any, you know, conclusions about the effectiveness, but our initial response is that we do think it's an effective tool to enhance customer communication. And we have embraced it as an industry and are trying to work through the compliance issues associated with that. And beyond that, you know, ultimately where we're really at is returning to a time of stability and a recovery of our housing market. It's in all of our best interests. So moving through this process, helping as many people as is reasonably possible to stay in their homes, dealing with implementing the new regulations that are coming out regularly at the federal level in order to assure that origination of mortgage loans is a more sound practice in the future is all very important to us. And we need to do this with balance and to assure that we maintain availability of credit and keep the cost of credit reasonable for the average American, all while assuring that they are sustainable loans that they can keep into the future. So be happy to answer questions now or after Mr. Ambrose.
I think we'll let Chris go, and then we'll have questions.
Great.
Thanks.
Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee. My name is Chris Ambrose. I'm here both as a private practitioner with Ambrose Law Group as well as on behalf of the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association. The OMLA is the Oregon branch of the Mortgage Bankers, the National Mortgage Bankers Association. As Mr. Fennell and Ms. Navarro have identified, we have been asked, and I certainly will focus on 628 and would be happy to answer any other questions on other areas. There's obviously been a lot discussed here today. From our perspective, and the OMLA and my personal practice, and from polling other attorneys that, as best I can, to reiterate, 628 is simply too new in the process to really give a definitive conclusion on whether or not it is working or not. Thus far, it's been our experience, and again, from informal polling from others in this particular field, it appears that perhaps 5, maybe 10% of the foreclosures that have been commenced are actually resulting in returns of those particular forms. But again, the sample size is only in that 100 to 150 foreclosure range at this point in time, given the timing of it commencing, or the effective date of the statute, rather, in September. Therefore, it's a little bit difficult for us to rely and feel that this committee should be able to rely on the effectiveness of the return rate. As Mr. Fennell indicated, there also are a number of lenders out there that are still implementing their own practices and procedures with respect to this particular form because of the affidavit requirement in particular. They are going to have to be prepared when all is said and done to be able to provide an affidavit under penalty of perjury that supports the fact that they have complied with 628. A long-winded way of saying that we're still very new in the process. What we have been hearing through the testimony today is that we are talking apples and oranges with respect to what 628 was intended to cover. That only obviously covers loan modifications and the loan modification process after the commencement of a foreclosure action. We still have, as I've testified before, a national issue requiring national resolution with respect to national lenders and the loan modification process that they go through. Without question, God bless the counselors in this room and the others that are working in that area. It is a thankless process, and I can tell you that as an attorney on a number of blogs and or having access to a number of blogs and listservs and so on, the loan modification process is not any easier for attorneys that have been hired specifically by individuals to try and resolve the process with the national lenders. They are clearly overwhelmed, but I think more particularly, won't reiterate a lot of the testimony heard earlier today, there is a question of the ability of the servicers to be able to modify their loans once they have been securitized. Hence the reason we believe for a major delay in some of the foreclosures by the national lenders in the state of Oregon because of the need to make sure that they are in compliance with 628. They do take it seriously. And again, they do have to sign that, or a representative has to sign that affidavit under penalty of perjury during the process. From our perspective, what we've been seeing from the foreclosures that have been ongoing and that have been commenced after September of 2009. The reasons simply have come down to an ongoing frustration on the part of lenders, which is the borrower putting his or her head in the sand and failing to show up or respond to any inquiries until the last minute, in which case, in many instances, we're seeing the increase in the bankruptcy filings. Attached to the materials that have been presented, as Linda has also provided, are a couple forms that have been used. One is Exhibit 1 is a form that was prepared by a number of different attorneys to simply try and comply with the law as best they saw fit. The other one was prepared. Exhibit 2 was the loan modification request form that was prepared by the Oregon PLF, the Professional Liability Fund, which is the insurance carrier, if you will, for Oregon attorneys. So that is it, correct. The last page, I believe, of Exhibit 2 is the modification request form that was prepared by the PLF for purposes of being returned by borrowers. There has been some testimony earlier today about still some frustration on the part of borrowers with respect to the forms. I certainly would be happy to discuss what forms they've seen, what forms they've reviewed. The Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association is committed to being as clear as possible. That certainly was the attempt of 628 to try and develop a plain language form and a response form that was as clear as possible while still addressing some of the major issues. But if there's a hiccup in the process and people still, borrowers are still not understanding it, then certainly that would be something that we would like to address. Finally, with respect to loan modifications, as Ms. Navarro has identified, from the mortgage banker's standpoint, there have been far more modifications than what have been identified. And I apologize, I focused on 628, and I'd be happy to send the latest statistics that the MBA has received for Q4 of 2009. I guess it's all in what your definition of loan modification is. If it is loan modification, meaning only a permanent modification of the loan, either a reduced interest rate or a reduced payment plan over the life of the loan, certainly there are far less of those than there are of extensions or short-term modifications with the expectation that they are ultimately going to be leading to more modifications. Does that mean that the process is without fault at this point in time? Certainly not. Again, they are clearly overwhelmed at this point in time, but the modifications are happening. My recommendation to anyone that is frustrated with the process at this point in time is to contact the Oregon Mortgage Lenders Association or the Oregon Mortgage or the Oregon Bankers Association. There are numerous attorneys that are associated with the OMLA, as well as lenders that are associated with the OMLA that are willing to step in, primarily at this point in time from a contact standpoint, from the ability to, as with the counselors, to be able to hopefully access somebody that can provide a clear channel, maybe not a resolution, but at least an answer to whether or not they are going to be qualified for a modification or why they're not getting the answers that they are expecting. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much. I'm going to start with a question. I've noticed in looking at the loan modification request forms, and thank you, I think we have several examples. Some of them include language about requesting a meeting, and some of them do not. And so do you have any sense of why there's an inconsistency? One of the points that was brought up on behalf, I think John from Osberg brought up the fact that it's not completely clear that to the homeowners that they can request the meeting. I know it's in the original notice that comes, but in some of the loan modification request documents, like I said, the one on the front says request a meeting, and some of them don't say anything about a meeting.
Chair Bonamici, I'm happy to just take a stab at that, but I'd welcome other input. There were some of us who thought there could be even some statutory definition of the form beyond what was actually in the statute. But the lenders, I think, developed these forms pretty much on their own, although we provided a sample form and a two-page memo from our council right after session to all of our members as a suggested template. There is obviously with each company coming up there with their own form going to be some difference. What I will say is I don't have the statute in front of me, and I don't recall if the statute specifically required the form to state you may be eligible for an in-person meeting. If it in fact does and those forms need to be improved, I'm happy either way, really, to go back after this hearing and send a communication out to our members so that they're apprised of that either recommended or required improvement to the forms that they're using.
I appreciate that. And I don't have the language at my fingertips, but I believe it may be a bit ambiguous, as some statutes are. It's clear that the homeowner can request a meeting. What isn't clear is that the right to request a meeting needs to be in the notice. That's my understanding.
Well, that may very well be an improvement we need to make, and we'll take a look at that, and I'll have our council take a look at that as well. I would also like to note that we provided only the loan modification form, so if you're not as familiar with all the documents, I would just offer a reminder that document is accompanied by the two-page plain language notice form that was enhanced by Senate Bill 628 and that was established in the 2008 session and which we supported. And that's a very you know, clear document that provides additional information to the consumer, so they do not get this form as any kind of standalone document, so I would like to point that out as well.
Thank you. I just am trying to think about sort of human nature. If they get the notice, and it's on the top, and on the back side it says you may request to meet with your lender. And then they say, okay, but I have to fill out this form. So they put this down, and then they work on getting all the documents they need to fill this out. And nowhere does it say on some of these, here's where you request the meeting. So they send this in, and then they say, wait a minute, how do I get my meeting? This says I get a meeting, but this depends on who your lender is. You do have the opportunity to say that. So that would be, I think, a very welcome improvement to make sure that there's some place on that request form if the borrower...
And may I respond with one more comment? I absolutely think we can provide some additional communication to our members about the importance of and the intent. I will tell you that some of the forms that are in the packet I provided to you and one that I just saw you holding up, those are... that particular form is a community bank in the state that has had 10 foreclosures and one form returned requesting a in-person appointment, and they met with that borrower. So some of those forms are probably attributed to banks that may not even have the occasion to use those forms yet, too.
And, so. It could be that their form is clear enough that they got the person requesting the meeting and the others weren't, so they didn't. So we don't know. Yeah. Thank you. Senator Dredd.
Thank you, Chair. I think you probably heard a little bit about what I said before about an incentive. I really feel very strongly that bank originators or somebody that originated the loan that is trying to go through the foreclosure process has every incentive to renegotiate. And I base that on some information as far as in the bin market, for example, homes that sold for $250,000 that have been foreclosed on, some of them go as cheap as $50,000 after the person has left and the toilets have been removed, the light fixtures have been removed, the house has been vandalized, from every wall has been marred in some way. So I just don't see an incentive not to try to save your investment to a certain extent. The problem that I have is when those loans become sold on a secondary market for, say, 50 cents on the dollar, then there's incentive to foreclose. And my question, and you probably don't have the answer, but I would really like the information, is how many, what percentage of the loans that are foreclosed on in this state are loans that were sold on the secondary market?
A lot. Madam Chair, Senator Durrott, I simply don't have those statistics. I could certainly do my best to gather up as best we can. I'm even reluctant to even say anecdotally how many that is. I mean, definitely there is now the issue of loans that have been purchased on the secondary market where the focus is on distressed property. They're buying the loans for 10 cents on the dollar, and so if they take the property back, then they don't particularly care that it has been dramatically reduced in price. They're still going to make money off the deal. How prevalent that is in Oregon, however, I couldn't personally say.
Madam Chair? Senator Durrott, one observation I've had is that with respect to predatory purchasers of mortgages, is it's not so much the institutions that buy them for pennies on the dollar, it's the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 1% or under of the foreclosures that I see while I'm handling the foreclosure are sold to someone like that. And so it's fairly rare. It's out there, and it's actually more active in Oregon than I see in other states, but it's not a huge number.
Other questions?
Just one, Madam Chair. So I guess it does seem like these hearings always seem to me to have an Alice in Wonderland quality, because your panel always gets up here and says essentially, which I'm sure there's a lot of truth to this, that you are doing the best you can to implement these laws, and everybody is working really hard to try to modify loans, and, you know, everybody is doing what they can. And then the people in the back of the room are sitting there shaking their heads and looking incredulous because that's not the experience that they have had. So I think the question I would just pose to you today is, if one of those people sitting in the back of the room were a member of your family, for instance, and was calling you up and saying, I'm getting inconsistent instructions. Every time I call, they tell me, stop paying, start paying. What would you, I mean, just sort of simple good advice, what would you tell them to do in order to protect themselves and get the best they can out of a bad situation?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosenbaum, I mean, that's a difficult question, and it's an important question. I will say at the outset, we have no reason to believe that the folks that have had bad experiences working with their servicer or obtaining the modification that they want to obtain are telling anything but the truth. And we have acknowledged that there are challenges with staffing up and training to handle. One bank told me they get 100,000 calls a day. So mistakes have been made. There are people who haven't been assisted. I cannot speak to their individual circumstance. Certainly, if they were a member of my family, I would do what I could to help them access the appropriate counseling and legal services to help them to understand their options. And one thing I will point out is that, you know, in the last year and a half to 2 years where there's been sort of a bank bashing bandwagon going on all over the country, there's a lot of positive stories that don't get told. And I will tell you that banks, even banks that have been mentioned today, fund counseling centers, even those that appeared here today. They also fund, I don't know if you're aware, legal aid to a large degree through the IOLTA program. So there are a number of things that I think banks, traditional banks, banks that do business in the communities and support these their communities and live in their communities are doing to try to provide resources to organizations. And maybe there's more that needs to be done, but I would say that to answer your question, I think those services are outstanding, and I think they provide a value to people trying to navigate. I would hope that they could navigate through their lender, through their servicer, and get the customer service they need. But in a case where they're not, fortunately there's other services available and obviously more resources needed to support those services.
Well, I appreciate that answer because it did occur to me when they were talking about how overburdened and understaffed they are that you would be a very logical place to be giving grant funding to fund more training for more people to do that work. Mm-hmm. And so if that's already going on, it sounds like even more of it would be better.
I appreciate your comment.
If it were my family, I would refer them to a specialist in loan modifications, an attorney in particular. There are not a lot of them in the state of Oregon, but there are some that specialize in that because the biggest dilemma that it appears most of the borrowers that we've dealt with are having the ability to reach the correct person that can ultimately make a decision. Having said that, there are plenty of people that will not be approved during the loan modification process. They're not happy with that particular disapproval, and that is what ultimately makes the rounds. And as you might imagine, there are two sides to every story. And there are some lenders that will do a modification if the borrower is unemployed in the form of an extension. The bulk of lenders, however, will not. And ultimately, there is going to be that business decision that's made at the lenders, from the lender's perspective, that I'm not sure there's anything in the law that is going to particularly change their mind. They are making business decisions on what programs are available for what borrowers, and is it really our role to step into those business decision, that business decision process? I don't know if that answers your question or not, but getting back to that, there are certainly some borrowers, lots of borrowers, that are trying to go through the process, do the right thing. They would appear to qualify for a loan modification, and that's where I would put them in touch with a qualified loan modification attorney who can, quite frankly, jump some of the hoops.
That's a good segue into my question. Thank you, Mr. Ambrose. Because I've dealt with a couple of constituent cases where we had some of the same issues that Mr. Bartholomew was talking about, repeated need to send documents again and again and on hold and inconsistent information. And it seems that those types of things happen enough so that the lenders and servicers should develop some sort of practice of noting things in the file and making sure that their information is consistent. It seems that even from like a risk management perspective that they'd want to, you know, make sure that they had a good solid record of what they were telling their customers. So how difficult would it be for the lenders and servicers, and I guess ask Ms. Navarro and Mr. Ambrose, how difficult would it be to provide the homeowner with the reason for not giving the modification? You probably have it in your records anyway. Would it be a big burden to say, if you're going to say to someone, no, you aren't qualified and here's why? You already do that, it's my understanding, for the HAMP.
Yeah, Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, you know, I can't answer that without having a chance to go back and talk to more of my members, because they do, many of them do provide the reason. And so in examples where the reason's not provided, I don't know if there's a reason for that. If there's not a reason for that and a failure in a system that needs to be improved in terms of noting files, that also is done by servicers. And one thing I would point your attention to in the materials that I provided to you was an article in the New York Times that I thought was a very interesting article, where their financial reporter actually went and spent a day in the J.P. Morgan Chase Modification Center and drew some conclusions about the challenges that those folks face and the hard work that they're doing to try to help customers. So I would encourage you to take time to read that, and perhaps there's even make some sense for those of you who have interest for us to be able to put you directly in touch with some of our members to talk through what their processes are, what their processes are for noting files, as well as for informing customers of reasons that their loan's denied. I'll just add one more point, and that is that, again, I want to emphasize that there were a lot of mortgages, and a lot of them, frankly, originated outside of banks, I will say that should not have been made. They were predatory loans, and there is no reason we should ever return to a time where income verification is not part of the lending process for home loans. And at the federal level, they're certainly tackling these issues as we speak in Congress and through regulations that have been promulgated by the federal regulatory agencies. And I think that knowing we had a system that failed consumers, failed investors, failed on a lot of levels that we can't return to, may explain why there are, in fact, going to be some loans out there that can't be modified. I'm not drawing conclusions for any specific examples, because examples you may have heard from could be people that very well deserve a modification. I don't know those examples. But we do need to recognize that modification is only possible in, you know, a portion of the cases where borrowers are currently today in this economy unable to afford their mortgage loan.
I don't believe I can answer that, quite frankly, without, again, speaking with some other particular lenders. I do know anecdotally that there are concerns about providing more information, because we do tend to be in a rather litigious society. And in some cases, certainly not all, the reason may simply be that the loan may not be modified from a contractual standpoint based on the secondary market, and providing that answer is not always the answer that the borrower wants to hear. Is that a legitimate business reason from the lender's perspective? Perhaps. Is it something that the borrower is going to be happy with? Certainly not. So, Chair Bonamici, I honestly can't answer that without speaking, again, other than anecdotally, other than speaking with some individual lenders.
I appreciate that. It just seems like it would be in everyone's interest, regardless of whether it's going to be hard for the homeowner to accept the reason, to provide the reason, because if the homeowner doesn't have an income, they need to know you're not going to get a modification if you don't have an income, for example. And if it's for some reason that has to do with the secondary market, if you tell them that, it seems that then they'll move on and find some other alternative. But if they don't know why they're not getting a modification, they're going to continue to try to call and pursue it, and it seems like that just exacerbates their frustration. So it's my two cents. So if you could follow up on that, it would be, I think, useful for us to know. Any other questions? No? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This concludes our work for today, and I'm going to close the work session and adjourn the Senate Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs.
And we'll see you in February.